this one. Just, like, I got .284, which is what, because I guess you can definitely simplify it, it's gonna be 0 points, like, the season.
I will say, we didn't seem to grade too harshly on whether we were using sample or population information.
Yeah.
So, like, definitely, like, estimators, I didn't necessarily put a hat over them.
Oh.
But we didn't seem to care about that. I can't tell if he or the TA agreed or not.
That sounded like he does.
It's not, yeah, it really sounded like he did.
Did you guys choose to take the second?
So they what?
Did you say it's the second class this time?
Yeah, we have to.
They call it probability statistics from years, but really, the first one is just probability, and the second one is just statistics.
I see.
That way, I can do a deep dive on each of the subjects. We only covered, like, 3 chapters last semester.
Did not.
Yeah, tell me about it. I think it's one of those where we only have 2 stat classes as industrial engineers. So, but so much of our other classes rely on probability and statistics, so they really want to get that.
I have, like, a lot of friends in several majors, like, especially my psych friends, they, like, are trying to do research, and then they don't know how to do it in the data.
Oh.
And it's like, there's like, MSTAT class is not very good, it's too fast paced, like, learning anything, you know? I'm like,
yeah, no joke. For today, we have a class called operations research. It's like using statistical process control. I don't even feel like the 2 statistics classes I've taken are good enough for this.
Make every next class I take.
Well, okay, so last lecture before spring break. So maybe hope you guys can get home safely after today's lecture. So what I'm going to do today is I'm not going to be that ambitious. I just want to talk a little bit about more how we interpret linear transformations using basic function theory. The main goal here will be to figure out when a linear transformation function between 2 vector spaces is going to be invertible. So you can not only go from 1 vector space to another, but you can go back again. And this turns out to be now a really important topic. In fact, once you leave this course, one of the main things you study are vector space isomorphisms, not so much from Rn to Rn, but rather from more abstract vector spaces into Rn where you can do calculations. So let me start. I'll start today by reminding you what the range and kernel of a linear transformation is. We're going to figure out the dimensions of these guys. That's something I did not cover on Wednesday. And then a pretty simple criteria to figure out when a linear transformation, a function between 2 vector spaces, actually is invertible. So you can go back and forth between the 2 vector spaces. Okay, so first of all, a linear transformation is a function between 2 vector spaces that's compatible with scalar multiplication and with vector addition. So that up a little bit. And then what we have been exploiting this week has been the connection between linear transformation and matrices. On the one hand, if you have an n by n matrix, you can always create a function between 2 vector spaces that has these properties. All you have to do is regard the function as being defined by matrix multiplication. So for this, if A is an n by n matrix, in order for this multiplication to be defined, you have to take X to be a column vector with the same number of entries as you have columns of the first factor, which would be m. So m would have to be an m by 1 column vector And so it would naturally fit inside Rm. But after you do the matrix multiplication, you end up with a column vector that's n by 1. And so you end up over here. So if you simply have a matrix with n rows and n columns, you can always create a linear transformation that takes you from Rm to Rn via this rule. Going the other direction, if you have a linear transformation between two vector spaces, you can use it to create a corresponding matrix that will have a similar property as this. What we do is we apply the linear transformation to each of the standard basis vectors of the domain. That will give us a column vector. We'll write the result as a column, and then what we end up with is an n by m matrix via this construction. And I guess the point of that construction, to be explicit, is this new function that this new matrix that we define this way, it's going to have the property that T of X is exactly equal to AT of X. So that will give us an alternative way of implementing this function. We can do it directly by whatever formula prescribes the n components in terms of the image point in terms of the m components of the original vector. Well, we could also implement that same function just using a matrix and do matrix multiplication. Okay, so the upshot of this is that linear transformations are basically one-to-one with matrices, and which one you use in any particular circumstance is just going to depend on that circumstance, which presentation of a linear transformation is more efficient. What we do know about when we represent linear transformations in terms of matrices is these guys are just ordered lists of numbers, so they're eminently calculable. All right, now, in addition to having matrices associated with a linear transformation, we also have some subspaces associated with linear transformations. The first one, so-called range, let me draw a picture up here that we'll be using throughout today's lecture. I'm going to distinguish between two cases, function theory, which you should think of as more general than linear transformations. So this is going to be a special case of function theory, but we still have this general setting. You have a function f that takes you from one set to another set, call this set B, call this set A. We have some subsets of the domain and codomain just from this picture. First of all, you have, let me try it over here. Just because you have a function between two sets doesn't mean that every point in the codomain is reachable by that function. Inside your codomain is going to be what's called the image of your function. And that's the set of points that you can think of sort of as the shadow of A inside B. What I mean by shadow is that every point inside this shaded area, you're to regard as being f of some a. So here's an element of a, it gets mapped over here, and it ends up inside this image. All right, now that's just from general function theory. In linear transformation, rather than these sort of blobs, these Lens diagrams of sets, we're actually dealing with vector spaces that are getting mapped to other vector spaces. So this might be Rm and going to Rn. And now we'll talk about linear transformations as special functions mapping between two vector spaces. And what corresponds to this notion of an image of a function is actually going to be a subspace of your codomain Rn. But in the setting of linear algebra, you don't have just some blob over here. Rather, your image is going to be a subspace. So I'll represent it as sort of a hyperplane. And in fact, we have it use a different name. We don't call it the image of a linear transformation. We call that the range of T. It's all the points in the codomain, your target space, that you can reach by applying your linear transformation to a point in your domain. All right, so that's called the range. And what we saw last time is that we can actually calculate that thing directly as we can form the matrix that corresponds to our linear transformation. And that subspace, the range of T, is going to be identical to the column space of the associated matrix. Now, there's another special subspace attached to a linear transformation that doesn't really, I mean, I can develop a function theory analog of it, but I'd just as soon describe it directly. We'll have a subspace of the codomain that consists of all the points in the domain that get mapped to the zero vector in the codomain. So starting here in the codomain, you apply the function T you brought over to the codomain. What we're focusing on here is a subset of points in the domain that always land on the zero vector there. That's called, that should be a vector there. That's called the kernel of the linear transformation. And it's also relatable to the matrix that corresponds to the linear transformation. It's in fact the null space of that matrix, meaning to find this kernel, you have to, you can find it by solving this linear system. Okay, so those are the two subspaces I talked about on Wednesday. What I wanted to do today initially is just tell you what their dimensions are. So, remember, if you have a n by n matrix, we had a theorem that said that the number of columns of this matrix is equal to the rank of the matrix plus the nullity of the matrix. What are those precisely? Well, the rank is either the dimension of the row space or the dimension of the column space. It's going to be the same number. And the reason why it's the same number is because dimension is the number of basis vectors, the number of independent directions you need to reach every point in your subspace. Well, the way we get basis vectors for the row space is we grab the non-zero rows of a row echelon form. Every non-zero row is going to have a pivot. So you can count the dimension of this guy by simply counting the number of pivots in a row echelon form of the matrix. But similarly, for the column space, the way we get a basis for that is we figure out where the pivots live in the row echelon form. We go back to the original matrix and we grab the corresponding columns. But the number of columns that's going to number of columns we use in a basis for the column space of A is equal to the number of pivots in this row echelon form. So basis vectors for the row space and basis vectors for the column space are constructed two different ways, but the starting point is the same. You look at the pivots in the row echelon form. So you'll have the same number of basis vectors, whether you're looking at the column space or the row space. So the dimension is the same. We call that common dimension the rank of a matrix. And then the null space of a matrix, well, that's the solution set of A times X is equal to zero. And the dimension of that space, well, it's going to be equal to the number of free parameters you have in this linear system after you solve it. And number of free parameters is actually equal to the number of columns that do not contain pivots in the any row echelon form of A. And so what you should notice here is I count the number of basis vectors in each of these subspaces. They're all related to the number of pivots we have in the row echelon form. To get the rank, we count the number of columns with pivots. To get the nullity, we get the number of columns without pivots. If I add these two numbers, columns with pivots, columns without pivots, I get the total number of columns. So that's what I have here. And I'm just saying that if I add the number of columns without pivots to the number of columns with pivots, I just sum these two. So we have this relation between the number of columns of the matrix and the dimensions of these two subspaces. Well, similarly, if we have a linear transformation, we're going to have a relationship between the dimensions of the range of T. That's that subspace over here in the codomain, and the dimension of the kernel of T. That's a subspace of your domain. And it turns out that the dimension of the kernel plus the dimension of the range is exactly equal to the dimension of your domain, which will be M. And it's pretty easy to see that. All we have to do to get this formula is express the range of T and the kernel of T in terms of the matrix that's attached to the linear transformation. What we'll have is M, well, what's M? When I make the matrix corresponding to this linear transformation, I get exactly M columns, one for each standard basis vector for Rm. And then I can split those columns up into columns that contain pivots when I take the row echelon form of that matrix, and columns that don't contain pivots when I take the row echelon form of those matrix. But this number of columns of any row echelon form without pivots, that's dimension of the column space, the rank or the dimension of the column space, and number of columns without pivots is the dimension of the solution set, AT of X is equal to zero, with the dimension of the null space. But the column space of this matrix is exactly the range of T, and the null space of that matrix is exactly the kernel of T. And so we do get that this identity, that the range of these two particular subspaces always has to add up to the dimension of the domain. Later on, when we start interpreting linear transformation, this is sort of important. And the way I like to think about it is the domain is an m-dimensional space, but this function does not carry all the information about this m-dimensional space over to this new vector space Rn. It could lose some information. Well, the subspace here that get mapped to the zero vector, that gets trivialized. All these vectors here get mapped to this zero vector that really has no effect on anything over here. So I regard the kernel of linear transformation as the information that's lost when I move from one vector space to another. And then what remains is the range. And so what you should think of the range of T is it corresponds to the information or the dimensions that are carried over into the new vector space. So this is sort of information loss and the information that passes through. Yeah.
So if we subtract the dimension of the range from the dimension of the original subspace, then we get
right. So that means that if you were simply wanted to know dimensions, you might have to calculate the dimension of the range. But then once you calculate that, you would just subtract that number from M, and then you would get the dimension of the kernel. Or vice versa, you could find the dimension of the kernel and then subtract that number from M, and you would get the dimension of the range. So that's really convenient. It gives us you don't necessarily have to find bases for both subspaces to get their dimension. All right, so that's one thing I wanted to present to you today. A second thing I wanted to do is to show you how you compose linear transformations. So let me remind you first what it means to compose two functions. Suppose I have a function. Now we're talking just about general sets. If a function from a set A to a set B and another function from the set B to the set C, I can combine those together. Well, actually, I can even be looser than this. All I really require is that the image of F sits inside the domain of this function. But once I have that situation, I can define a new function that's going to take me from my original domain to the codomain of the second function. So I'll go directly from A to C. That's called composition. This is how you do it. You take a point in your domain, you calculate it's the value of F at that point. That puts you in B, but B is in the, this guy here is going to end up being in the domain of G, so I can apply G to that point, and I get a new value. So here's the picture. Three sets, A, B, and C, a function between A and B, a function between B and C, and the compose function is where you go directly from A to C via G of F of A. Okay, so we can, this works for, in general function theory, it also works for linear transformations. What I want to show you is, what happens to the associated matrix under these composition rules. And what we'll see is that the if I have two linear transformations, a linear transformation goes, say, from Rm to Rp, and another linear transformation that's going from from Rm to Rn is T, and Rn to Rp is a linear transformation S, I can compose the two linear transformations and end up with a linear transformation that goes from Rm to Rp, just doing, again, functional composition. The statement of the theorem here is that the associated matrix is just going to, you can obtain that by calculating the corresponding matrices for these two guys and then just multiplying the matrices together rather than figuring out exactly what this function is and then constructing its matrix. So let me give you an example so that you see more explicitly what I'm talking about. So let's see, up here I have a function that's taking two-dimensional vectors to three-dimensional vectors. In the second line I have a function that's a linear transformation that's taking me from three-dimensional vectors to two-dimensional vectors. When I compose them, well, that's done by substitution, as you would do in say, a calculus course. Bring this down a little bit. To compute this compose function, the first thing I do is I apply t to a point with coordinates x1 and x2. Well, that produces this result. And now what I'll do is I'll apply s to this thing, but I'll use this formula for s. So the result of this is I'm going to have to add the first two coordinates together. So the first coordinate is going to be x2 plus x1. There it is. And then the second coordinate is just the third variable. Where do we end up? It's just the third variable, x1 plus x2. So that's the composition. And now that we have an explicit function taking a two-dimensional vector to a two-dimensional vector, we can calculate the corresponding matrix. Now, remember, let me remind you how that's done. What you do is the matrix corresponding to a given linear transformation, you form that by taking the standard basis vectors of your domain. And in this case, the domain is two-dimensional. So we have two standard basis vectors, t and 0, 1. And what we do then is we figure out where this vector goes, and we write its components vertically to get a column of this matrix. Similarly, we find out where this goes, and we write its columns vertically. So let's see. When x1 is 1 and x2 is 0, what happens over here? We get 0 plus 1, 1 plus 0, or we get 1, 1. And that explains this column, and the same thing is going to happen for the second. When the second standard basis vector, which has component 0 and 1, it's going to get mapped to 0 plus 1 and 0 plus 1, where it's going to, again, equal 1, 1. Okay, so that's composing these functions by hand by substituting the value of t into the argument of s and then working out the details. And then I have a linear transformation that I can compute its matrix. what I'll show you next is that I could also calculate the matrices for the individual components of this compose function. So let's see, for the matrix for T, I take the first standard basis vector, 1, 0, I evaluate it, that would be 0, 1, 1, and so 0, 1, 1, and then for second column would be, I guess, 1, 0, 1, and yeah, I got that right. And let's see, for S, first standard basis vector is going to go to 1, 0, 1 plus 0, 0. Second standard basis vector is going to go to 1 and 0. And the third standard basis vector, that's where only y3 is non-zero, is going to go to 0 and 1. And what you'll, I think I went on page here, maybe. No, still there. What I'll show you is like now, this compose function, its matrix could be determined from the matrices corresponding to the functions from which S composed with T was formed. And in fact, if you take this matrix, the matrix for S, and then you multiply it by the matrix for T, not only is the matrix multiplication going to be defined, it produces the correct matrix. So what I get by multiplying these two matrices corresponding to the linear transformation T of S together, what I get is the matrix for the compose representation or compose function. So it all works out. This this business of going treating linear transformation as matrices or matrices as linear transformation, it's all compatible with one another. The basic statement here is this composition of functions is now going to be at the level of matrices. It's going to be matrix multiplication. And that can be a lot easier than to compute to this matrix by multiplying these matrices together than it would be to, now let's imagine a linear transformation with a large number of variables. So maybe from R10 to R25. If I was going to compose functions between two large matrices, then I'd have to awful lot of substitutions to do. I'd have to substitute the value into the new function, and then you have to substitute and see where everything goes. And that's sort of an error-prone calculation because it's more algebra rather than just manipulating numbers. But once we convert over to this matrix formulation, it's easy to calculate the individual matrices. You can basically just read it off the definition of the functions. And then to get the composition, it's really easy to just multiply those matrices together. Okay, so it may be that next week I'll show you a practical example of this. One thing I like to do that I don't think I'm going to do today is if you have a a linear transformation, I guess it looks like this, sine theta, cosine theta. If you have a linear transformation whose matrix looks like this, what this matrix represents is it's a matrix that implements a rotation by an angle theta in the plane. Hopefully, whether in your physics or engineering classes, you've seen rotations implemented via matrix multiplication. You take any vector here, x and y, and you apply this matrix to that column vector, what you get is a new vector that would be the, this vector rotated by an angle theta. What you can do is you can take these two matrices and you can, let's call that a theta, and a phi would be a similar matrix, theta, so sorry, cosine phi, sine phi, minus sine phi, sine phi, what you could do is you could, the combined action of a rotation by theta followed by a rotation by the angle phi would be the composition of the two linear transformations, or in this view, it would be just be multiplying these two matrices together. And in fact, what should happen? If you multiply by an angle theta, and then you follow it by a rotation by an angle phi, the total rotation is going to be theta plus phi, right? You go an angle theta, and then you go further by an angle phi. And so the total rotation would be phi plus phi. If you multiply these two matrices together, what's going to get kicked out by that are the trig identities that tell you what the cosine of phi plus theta is actually going to be. But I'll demonstrate that maybe next week. It's a nice way to derive a trig identity. Just all you have to do is write down the matrices and multiply the matrices together, and you get both the trig identities for sine of theta plus phi's product of cosine and sine functions of phi and phi. And you also get the trig identity relating the cosine of the sum of angles from this, simply multiplying these two matrices together. But if I do that calculation, I'm going to not finish today's lecture. So I'll do that on Monday, maybe. What I want to do today is instead talk about invertibility of functions. So if you have a function between two sets, remember that the image of the function is not necessarily the entire codomain. The image is usually some subset. It's all the points in the codomain that are reachable by applying your function to all the points in A, you map them over, in general, you get some subset of the codomain. We call that subset the image. It's a, in the case of linear transformation, we call this the range. But I'm going to introduce some new nomenclature here. Anytime we have a function between two sets, and in fact, we can reach every point in the codomain by applying the function to some point in F, then we say that the function is surjective or onto. What that means is that every point in the codomain is reachable by applying the function to some point in A. This notion is going to be related to whether or not this function from A to B actually has an inverse function. So it's going to depend on two criteria. The first one is this notion of surjectivity. Just basically says that every point in the codomain is reachable by applying the function. And then there's a second notion in basic function theory called injectivity. That's a different condition. We say that a function between two sets is injective if anytime the value of the function at two points is the same, that in fact they had to come from the same point. So what we're eliminating here when we talk about a function that's not injective is to have a point A and a point A double prime, a function between the two sets. What we're eliminating here is that two distinct points in the domain getting mapped to the same point in the codomain by the application of the function. So that's what we mean by non-injective. By injective, the only way the values can stay the same is if they come from the same point. All right, so those are sort of abstract definitions about functions between two sets that are explained largely using pictures. But what's really surprising about it is that these notions of injectivity and surjectivity are sufficient. Actually, let me give you some example of these things. Here's my favorite example function, x goes to x squared. This function is neither injective or surjective. It's not surjective because the domain consists of all real numbers, but when you square a real number, you only get non-negative numbers. So the negative numbers here cannot be reached by applying this function to real numbers. And so this function is not surjective, not the negative numbers in the codomain cannot be reached by applying this function. Nor is it injective because the numbers 1 and minus 1, they land on the same value in the real numbers. So because these two values of x have the same value as a function of f, this thing is not injective. But these two properties, surjectivity and injectivity, if you don't have them, you can often impose them by simply restricting your domain. So the reason why this was not surjective is because this set was too big. It contains the negative numbers, and the negative numbers were never reachable. So if I restrict the codomain to be only non-negative numbers, then this problem, having numbers in the codomain that are not reachable by this function, I've eliminated that. I've eliminated all the numbers that are not reachable by redefining my codomain. And similarly, I can eliminate this duplicity, the fact that 1 and minus 1 land at the same point 1. I can eliminate that by restricting my domain to just throw out all those negative numbers. And so if you start off with a function that's neither surjective or injective, by redefining your domains, you can typically make it that way. But they're important properties because if a function is both injective and surjective, in that case we call it bijective, it has the property that it always will have an inverse function. That there'll be a function f the minus first, that when it's going to go from your original codomain back to the original domain, it's going to, when you compose it with f, you get back when you started with, or if you do the opposite combination, if you go to f to b and then use the invert, the f the minus first, you go back to a, you get back to where you started with. So here's the point of introducing all that abstraction. It turns out that you're guaranteed an inverse of a function whenever that function is both surjective and injective. I'll show you how that works. And in fact, it's an existence argument. I don't actually calculate in this argument what this inverse is. I'm just going to argue abstractly that it does exist. Yeah, question?
Yes. So whenever there's a surjective value, I meant an injective value, does that mean there's repeated values? And
that's what you're eliminating. If you have different values come from different points naturally, but what you don't have are two different points landing on the same point. So if you start from two different distinct points and the function is injective, that means when you map both points over, they land on different points. They don't coalesce. They don't sort of collapse into a single point. So this is the situation that you avoid when it's injective. Two different points landing on the same point.
So in the example, you said 1 is not equal to -1, right?
Right, because if f of x equals x squared, then f of minus 1 is equal to 1. But that's the same thing as equal to f of 1, right? So I have two different points in the domain that are getting mapped to the same point. So this is not injective. So no, the reason I'm introducing this concept is what I'm really interested in is when can I, if I have a function from A to B, when can I go from B back to A? And it turns out that I can answer that question simply by observing whether the function is both injective and surjective. Here's the rationale. Suppose I try to define this function f to minus first, that's going to actually be the inverse of this function, so that I can go pass back and forth between these two sets. Well, if it's surjective, anytime I choose a point B here, it had to come from something over here. So then I would call this, I would go back here, and maybe this is f of A for some A. And then if I had another point here, B prime, that would be equal to f, say, of A prime for some A prime. Now, what I want to do from this picture is define a function that will take me from B to A. Well, so here I have two different points of B. I don't want them landing on the same point over here, because then I wouldn't, if I start off with two different points, I should end up at two points here. And so these guys can each be pulled back, but they can't land on the same point because of surjectivity. If I start off with distinct points here, they had to come from distinct points here. But now I can go back and forth. This goes to here, and then it goes back to there. And this goes back to here, but then it goes back to there. And so simply from this drawing, really, you can prove this theorem that for every point here, there does exist a unique point over here that lands on that point. And only one point over here can land on that point because it's injective. So you're guaranteed that it comes from some point, and that's surjectivity. And then injectivity guarantees that you couldn't have a choice of points over here from which to call the inverse of A.
But then you wouldn't know which one to go back to.
Yeah, so for a function, it has to have a unique value. So if I had two points landing on the same point here, I wouldn't know whether to choose this as F, the inverse of this point, or this as the inverse of this point. But because it's injective, I don't have to make that choice. There's only one choice. So you get this theorem really just by looking at this diagram and arguing logically. But what's nice is that we'll have a nice linear algebraic interpretation of the situation that's going to be related to the kernel and range of a matrix. So remember, a linear transformation is a function, so it's still inside the setting of this general function theory. And all we're requiring is that it's compatible with scalar multiplication and vector addition. So the first thing I want to point out is now regarding a linear transformation as a function, it's going to be surjective if and only if the range is equal to the entire codomain. Well, that's just definitions. The range of T is exactly the same thing as the image of T, thinking of T as a function rather than as a linear transformation. And so a function is surjective if its codomain is equal to its image, but the image is just equal to the range. So if the range equals the image, is equal to the codomain, then you have surjectivity. It doesn't have to equal M. So for example, you could have a two-dimensional plane mapping onto the line. And maybe you take it, think of this as X and Y space, and the function is going to just map to the X coordinate. Well, here you have a two-dimensional space mapping to a one-dimensional space, but it completely covers that space. So, but you're pretty close to an important point. If we actually have a linear transformation that's both surjective and injective, it's going to have an inverse, and then then these two spaces are going to have the same dimension. But until we have an inverse, we don't know that yet. All right, so. So this is just easy. This is just realizing that the range of T is exactly the image when we think of T as a function between two sets, and that the definition of surjective simply saying is that the image is the same as the codomain. All right, so we have that, and then a linear transformation is injective. Well, that's the requirement that we don't want two different points in the codomain, or two different points in the domain, landing on the same point in the codomain. My claim here is that a linear transformation is going to be injective if and only if the kernel of that linear transformation consists of just the zero vector. Get that up there. All right, so I'll prove this to you. The goal here is to show that T of x1 equals T of x2 only if x1 is equal to x2. So this is if linear transformation is injective, it means if you have the same value, you had to come from the same point in the domain. And what I'm going to show you is that this condition is implied by the fact if the kernel is actually equal to zero. So the first thing I'm going to show you is that anytime you have a linear transformation, you evaluate it at the zero vector in your domain, you have to end up at the zero vector in the codomain. Why? All right, so here's T applied to zero. I can rewrite zero as x minus x. But because it's a linear transformation, I can delay that vector addition, or actually vector subtraction, until after I apply the linear transformation. I get that. And then here I'm subtracting the same vector from itself. I get zero. And so anytime you have a linear transformation, the zero vector always gets mapped to the zero vector. But this is the zero vector inside the domain. This is the zero vector inside the codomain. All right, so that's one observation. And now what I'll show you, let's see. Here's the kernel. It's the set of points in your domain that get mapped to the zero vector inside your codomain. Let's suppose we had a vector besides zero, such that T of x was equal to zero. Well, if T of x is equal to zero, we've just seen in the previous slide that T of zero always equals zero. And my hypothesis here is I had another vector besides zero that gets mapped to the zero vector. But if it's injective, that can't happen. I have two different vectors landing on the same spot. So if T is injective, two vectors that land on have the same value after the application of T, that cannot happen when you're injective. So if X is not equal to zero, then we would get a contradiction. So that means that the only vector that maps to zero is actually the zero vector itself. And that's just a statement that the kernel of T, the only vector that maps to the zero vector, has to be exactly the zero vector. So what I've shown on this slide is that T is injective, then necessarily the kernel of T consists of a single point, the zero vector. All right, let's go the opposite way. Suppose the kernel of T consists of a single vector, the zero vector. And let's, I'm going to now show you that the function t is injective. So suppose we, I have two points in the domain that land at the same spot. So the values of the linear transformation is the same. Well, I can move this term to the opposite side. End up, well, move this term to the opposite side. I subtract t of x2 from both sides of t of x1 from both sides of that equation. You get this relation. Subtract one from the other. You get 0 is equal to the difference. And then because it's a linear transformation, I can delay that vector subtraction. I can actually carry that out before I apply the linear transformation. And then what I have is that 0 has to equal t applied to x1 minus x2. My hypothesis here is that the kernel of t consists of a single vector 0. So that tells me that if the kernel of t is equal to 0 and t applied to x1 minus x2 is equal to 0, that means that, well, this is the only guy whose value evaluates to 0. So that means x1 minus x2 has to equal 0. Well, if that's true, that means that x1 has to equal x2. So what's the upshot of this? If t is surjective, so here's t from Rm to Rn, a general linear transformation. If t is surjective, well, that corresponds to the range of t equaling the entire codomain. It's saying that this set is entirely covered by applying t, and t is injective. What this slide shows you, that happens exactly when the kernel of t consists of only the zero vector. And so, if both these conditions hold, or equivalently, if these two conditions hold, then t is going to be both surjective and injective, and so it will have an inverse. So, theorem, if t from Rm to Rn is 1, you have the range of t equaling the entire codomain, and second of all, that subspace kernel of t is equal to just the zero vector, then you have an inverse transformation. All right, now what good does this do us? If we have a function between two vector spaces, I know how to calculate this. The range of t just turns out to be the column space of the associated matrix. The kernel of t, that turns out to be the null space of the associated matrix. So once I have a linear transformation, I can easily determine these two subspaces, and then I can define, I can see whether or not the linear transformation actually has a subspace. I just have to calculate those two things and verify I get the right result. So both of these conditions are calculable from the associated matrix. And so I don't actually have to explicitly construct this inverse matrix to know that it exists. Rather, I could just look at the associated matrix, verify that the range is indeed all of the codomain, and that the kernel of T consists of only the zero vector, then I know that that exists. Okay, so, I ran 3 minutes over. So let me stop here. I wish you guys a restful spring break, and we'll pick up again next Tuesday. Oh, by the way, I said that the second exam was likely to be the week right after spring break. I'm going to relax that. I think it's actually more likely that we do it maybe Monday, the Monday, the week after the week we come back from spring break. Because I want to go over this material better on the Monday afterwards. And I just as soon give you another class meeting to sort of consolidate things before I test you on it. So what's likely to happen after spring break is we'll come back and I'll rehash some of this material, maybe go over homework problems and the like on Monday, maybe do new material on Wednesday. And if we do have the exam on the following week, then we can do a review session on Friday. I think that would work out best for everyone. Okay? All right, so have a good break, and I'll see you in a week or so.